Hello, welcome to the Ornstein and Chapman podcast on The Athletic. As usual, we'll bring you exclusive and original stories and interviews offering agenda-setting insight from inside the game from David and our writers across The Athletic. All of our podcasts are free. Ad-free versions are available to subscribers to The Athletic. And of course, on The Athletic, you'll find plenty of great articles, even with no football being played. If you go there now, you'll get access completely free for 90 days, theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. Free access for 90 days. David, it was a turbulent week of meetings last week involving the Premier League and club representatives and players themselves. We're recording this on Monday afternoon. Just take us back to what you know about how it panned out towards the end of last week and over the weekend.
Various interested parties, players, clubs, associations, unions have all been talking since this crisis kicked off. That really came to a head on Friday when the Premier League held its most recent meeting. And despite sort of some strides being made around the PFA and the players and the clubs, a unified position was established among the 20 clubs that they would be recommending pay cuts or deferrals from their players amounting to 30%. So bang, there you go. That's the first real stake in the ground. On Saturday, various different parties again met in a conference call that had many of the players and managers on. And that didn't bring about such progress. But what it did bring about was a clear feeling among the players that this 30% that is being asked for is going to be very difficult to bring about. They weren't really consulted about it. And the feeling from the PFA is that they'll sort of reject it because it's so complicated. The amount that 30% would potentially strip the government of in taxes that footballers pay would potentially be very detrimental to public services and the NHS. The players want to contribute in slightly different ways. The players also want to donate to the NHS to help the lower paid staff at their clubs. And so we have this position where some people have described it to us as a bit of a war, a standoff, because the players do not want their money just lining the pockets of the club executives. Some people have described it as complete deadlock, and despite an initial will to have struck a collective agreement across the board, it really does seem now that the clubs are going to have to negotiate with their players on a group basis, separate to other clubs, or even on an individual player-by-player basis, because there are so many issues, so many different complications and nuances at stake in all of this, that it's just not easy to implement something across the board. And some clubs are already doing it, and that's annoyed some other clubs who wanted the universal stance. And I've had a lot of questions asking where this 30% has come from. I've seen what was presented to the players in that conference call on Saturday, and I'll try and explain it to you as briefly as possible.
This was presented to the players by whom before on Saturday?
The Premier League, essentially.
Okay.
This was the Premier League's first attempt to outline the 30% to the players that emerged on Friday and caught many of these players by surprise. So the Premier League clubs make around £5 billion. That's made up of broadcast money, 60%, commercial income, 24%, and match day income, around 16%. The clubs spend pretty much all of that £5 billion. 50% of it, remember that figure, 50% goes in player costs, player wages, 26% in transfers, 24% in other staff costs. The Premier League estimates that the losses that the clubs will be incurring from the COVID crisis, the broadcast field, so we'll split this into two, broadcast and match day. In the broadcast field, the losses, as The Athletic have reported, £762 million collectively. The losses in the match day field and the commercial sector, £375 million. So a total loss from COVID predicted to be £1.14 billion. Now, back to that 50% figure. If player wages account for 50% of club costs across the Premier League, 50% of that £1.14 billion is £570 million. Player wages across the Premier League, their basic wage comes to £1.9 billion. £570 million is 30% of player wages across the Premier League. 30% of player wages is the 50% of the losses to the Premier League. So players are being asked to cover 50% of the losses that COVID is causing. And that, in essence, is 30% of their basic wages. From that 30%, around 10% has been identified as match day income and around 20% broadcast income. So if the matches take place in front of crowds and the 2019-20 season is completed in front of full stadiums, they will get that 30% that they're being asked to cut back. In the likelihood that it doesn't, very likely, then the matches go behind closed doors, they will lose just the 10% because clubs aren't earning match day income from playing behind closed doors, but they are getting the broadcast income, 20%. Over the next 12 months, clubs are recommended to roll this out. In this document, it also says that clubs should protect their lower paid players and that this could apply to managers and senior coaching staff as well. It's understood that David Moyes is among the managers who has already indicated to his club, West Ham, that he'd be prepared to take a cut or deferral. And just to be clear, if matches are played in full stadiums, the players would get a full reinstatement. If matches are played behind closed doors, they would get a 20% reinstatement because the matches are on television, they save the broadcast money, they would lose 10%. However, in all of this, this is just recommendations from the Premier League. The players are not compelled to accept it. It seems many of them would reject it, and that is why it will come down to individual negotiations, and that is why this is going to take a long time, and it's why some clubs, such as Liverpool, who are furloughing their lower paid staff, are saying, we are not waiting to strike the player agreements before announcing our lower paid staff agreements, because these negotiations over the players could go on for weeks and potentially longer.
Simon Hughes is with us, who writes about Liverpool for The Athletic as well. Hi, Simon.
Hiya.
Just before we come on to Liverpool, I don't know how much of what David said there you're hearing for the first time, but I heard that breakdown is the first time that I have heard that. We hadn't rehearsed it. We hadn't talked about it before. Right, so I'm putting myself in the position of a player here. And the Premier League are basically telling me, as I understand it, if I was sitting there, hang on a minute, you're asking me to give back 30% of my wages just to cover your losses, right? And yet you are some incredibly wealthy owners, not every owner of a football club, but there are a lot of incredibly wealthy owners in a very wealthy league. Well, hang on a minute. To me as a player, that doesn't sit right. However, if you'd sat down and gone, we want you to defer 15% of your wages or 30% of your wages. And I tell you what that's going to do. That's going to help pay all of our staff, all our lowest paid ones, the ones in the ticket shop, the one in the club shop, the ones who work on match day. It will cover all of that so we don't have to go to the government. Then you'd feel like you were doing some good. But at the moment, I don't know how you read it, but it's that sells me, oh, God, we're going to make all of these losses. We need you to bail us out.
I think, you know, it's a reminder, really, that the players are, you know, they're very suspicious of most people's intentions, really, because of the very unusual world in which they operate in. You know, players do value trust immensely. And just because they sign for a football club doesn't mean that they necessarily trust implicitly what the people who they're signing for are saying and doing. You know, they tend to sign for football clubs because of the possibility of winning trophies, and B, maybe B is actually an A because of the money that they're being promised. You know, the size of the football club as well. They don't sign for football clubs based on their owners necessarily, directly, and will sometimes privately have views of the football owners, but park those views and put them to one side because ultimately, that the pros outweigh the negatives. Now, that's sort of highlighting this a little bit at the moment. I mean, why should any player forsake so much amount of their income when it's just bailing out another very wealthy person and it's not actually going to causes that are actually relevant? You know, I mean, you mentioned Liverpool there, and, you know, I think it's quite clear over the last week, really, that Jordan Henderson's been sort of trying to corral the other captains in the Premier League to try and come to some sort of common consensus. Now, there's a perception at the moment, and it I think has been pretty appalling from the government, to be honest, to be singling out Premier League footballers as the sort of the key to everybody's problems at the moment because of the wealth that they generate. Premier League footballers, I'm not saying they all are, because there are some who are single-minded and will base their decisions sometimes based on finance, but that doesn't mean that all of them are. And I think, you know, if you look behind the scenes and listen and read about what Premier League footballers have done in the last sort of, certainly the last 5 to 10 years, there's a lot of charitable sort of donations made. The players would rather, if they are going to forsake money, make sure that it's going to go to the right causes at this time, and not just protect people who fundamentally, you know, aren't going to be affected in a massive way.
Just before we do Liverpool, Simon, just let me go back to David on that. Do you think, from your knowledge of this situation and from players that you have heard from, that it is principle rather than finance that is causing the block here or the disagreement?
Yes, I think it is point of principle. The players know they're extremely wealthy and they want to contribute. The reality is there are two sets of people who can sort this predicament out for the clubs. The players, because their salaries are the biggest cost on a club, and the owners, who in many cases are billionaires or extremely wealthy. And yes, they have other business interests, but some of the money we're talking about here would be a drop in the ocean for them, and we haven't heard from them at all yet. I don't think anyone should be blaming or pointing or expecting, but the fact of the matter is the two areas that can sort this out are the players or the owners. Well, Chappa said we'd come to Liverpool, and he wasn't wrong. We recorded this podcast on Monday afternoon, and in this section, the three of us discussed Liverpool's decision to furlough some non-playing staff, meaning they would be in part funded by the government. But since we initially recorded, after a huge backlash, there has been a change of heart, and Simon Hughes can tell us about it.
That Monday evening, around 6:30, a statement landed on Liverpool's website, which is quite a long statement. Quite interestingly, it's been signed off by Peter Moore, the chief executive. When Liverpool have made mistakes in the past and apologised for those errors, it's usually been the owners, one of John Henry or Tom Werner, or jointly signed, as I think they did when they backtracked on the £77 ticket scheme that they had in 2016. I mean, it's quite a long statement, but the crux of it arrives halfway down, where it says, "We believe we came to the wrong conclusion last week to announce that we intended to apply to the coronavirus retention scheme and furlough staff due to the suspension of the Premier League football calendar. And we are truly sorry for that." So that's a big apology from Liverpool. Further down the statement, it does remind that Liverpool do operate in a real financial world, and clubs off the back of this crisis are going to have to cut their cloth accordingly. And Peter Moore reminds that having these vital resources so profoundly impacted would obviously negatively affect our ability to operate as we previously have. Now, that doesn't really tally, I think, with that what that decision would have made, I think, because, you know, it depends how long football is suspended for, but, you know, potentially if it's 3 months, this would have cost Liverpool anything between £2 and £2.5 million. So in the grand scheme of things, OK, it's going to have an impact on Liverpool, but it's not a major impact. As I said a bit earlier on, I think there are more creative ways of dealing with this, rather than the decision that you arrived at. But you've got to give Liverpool credit for coming down and reacting to the fan base, because I do feel that if we just continue to criticise people, even when they do admit their mistakes, you know, it's not going to lead to much progression, and just potentially, you know, lead to more football clubs not apologising when they do make mistakes, as we've seen with other football clubs. The various clubs, Liverpool aren't the only club that have made a mistake over the last 5 to 10 years, and many of those don't have the humility to admit their errors.
Yeah, credit where it's due for the climb down. However, they did make the decision in the first place. And very interesting that you point out that Peter Moore has written the statement, when people I spoke to at and around Liverpool have said that this was a decision taken at ownership level, that the reaction just basically became untenable for them, and that this was a decision that was sort of emotion based on practicality. They couldn't go on with this kind of atmosphere around the club, the city. And I didn't sense a great deal of contrition about the original feeling, which, as you point out in that statement, they're facing real challenges, more the backlash. Do you think that's the crux of this? That they don't necessarily feel they made the wrong decision, but that the reaction was just something they wouldn't be able to cope with going forward, and they're going to have to find a solution to plug this gap through some other means?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, that the statement finishes on this, it almost feels a little bit like a veiled threat. I remember when Ian Eyre stood in front of the cameras as Peter Moore's predecessor as the chief executive, and it was the Friday before Liverpool played Sunderland, and the fans staged a mass stadium walkout, which had never been seen at Liverpool before. And Ian tried to justify the reasons why the club had made this decision. And pretty much warned the club, you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for, which sort of harked back to the old Hicks and Gillette era, which, yeah, fair enough, but the club is still making a mistake. It doesn't mean that because other owners have previously made mistakes that the current ownership were permitted to do whatever they wanted just because they were running the club in a far more responsible way. And the statement does sort of read a little bit like that. I agree that there isn't a great deal of contrition. But clearly, obviously, Liverpool can't hide away from the fact that they'd originally made that decision based around what they thought was right. They've reacted to this on the basis of how the fans have felt. It just really surprises me that they didn't see this coming. I mean, they've been Liverpool's owners for nearly 10 years now. And they've had similar reactions off the fan base at different times throughout their tenure. So, you know, they've got enough people at the club to understand how people in Liverpool feel. You know, particularly employment, it's a very sensitive issue in a city which has suffered, you know, over a number of decades. And I understand they may have felt that this would safeguard employment and that, you know, that in the long term, that the people might suffer unemployment because of you know everything that's going on, but ultimately you know there's a lot of people who work for the club who were furloughed who certainly didn't feel reassured by that decision. They felt more vulnerable, and I think when that happens, you know you're going to face problems because people in Liverpool they tend to talk as well. You know if you're not happy about something, people will talk about it. So it's clearly a mistake that they've made. I agree with you. I think you know it's three times now they've got the hat trick. You know it needs to stop, really. You know they can't just keep on making the same mistakes because it undermines all the good work that they do. As I said, I think FSG are very responsible owners, but it doesn't mean that they get everything right.
Yeah, and if you were to look at it on their side, you might point out that this is such an unprecedented situation that although they may have sensed some of the reaction, they might not have known the sheer extent of it. So I don't know, that might be their perspective. But if we move it on to the players, I'm pretty intrigued by how they may have reacted to this initial decision, especially Jordan Henderson, who's been so much on the front foot around efforts among players to donate to the NHS. Jurgen Klopp is such a principled manager in all of the public utterances we've heard from him about this and various other issues. People at Liverpool are telling me that this change of heart, this reversal of the decision, had nothing to do with the players or with Jurgen Klopp. But I wonder privately whether the likes of Henderson and Klopp had some quite strong feelings on the issue.
It would be unlike Jurgen Klopp not to have strong feelings on the issue. Equally, I could imagine that Jurgen Klopp could see the benefits of the decision that they'd made. In the first instance, but clearly they've got the message wrong, and not reassured the people this affected, and you know they haven't managed it particularly well at all. I mean, as I mentioned, I think in the podcast earlier, you know, let's be honest, that the newspaper there was a newspaper that broke this story. You know, those reporters have done their job properly. It was accurate, and they reported properly. So they've been sort of caught on the hop a little bit here, Liverpool. But you know, it's not a newspaper or journalist job to try and manage what Liverpool are doing. They clearly haven't dealt with it with the sensitivity that was needed. As you said, it is an unprecedented situation, and I don't think any football club is finding this easy. But I just think that, you know, they've had enough experience of running Liverpool now and knowing Liverpool and seeing the way people react to things to understand how the reaction would be to this. You know, that there are people who they employ at the club to speak about, you know, the cultural relevance of every decision that they make. So it's one that they've definitely got wrong. But, you know, the first rule of PR when you've made a big error is admit your error as quickly as possible, because the longer it goes on, the bigger problem it becomes. So maybe Liverpool have intercepted that for the time being. It's going to be interesting now because, you know, a lot of other football clubs are going to maybe find this, you know, find it hard to follow that path. Just touching on what you said about the players, I mean, I know that the players have been working very hard to try and figure out some sort of a plan which would safeguard not only people at Liverpool, but you know, obviously other elements of society, you know, the NHS. You know, that hard work, I would think, would have been undermined by this decision, because, you know, it would have looked like that the players had almost been forced by their own club into making this decision, when it might have been something that they'd done anyway. So the impression that I get is the communication across the club hasn't been as it should be, you know, of a matter of such importance.
Yeah, and I did think that, or I was told that the likes of Jordan Henderson, the squad, the playing staff and coaching staff were initially assured that there would be nothing done negatively in respect of the lower paid staff. And I suspect that the initial decision to furlough staff would have hit them pretty hard, and it'd be fascinating to know if there was any private consultation in the reversal of this decision, and why the owners' names weren't put on the statement and why it was Peter Moore. We've touched upon that. One thing we haven't touched upon is where things go from here. So I've scanned over some of the reaction, and immediately there's a lot of praise for Liverpool's climb down. There are a lot of people criticising the fact that they made the decision in the first place. Do you think going forward, this has, by and large, won back the people they needed to win back, won back the goodwill? Or do you think they face a bit of a problem going forward in terms of trust, and maybe it taking a bit of a gloss off of what has been a pretty spectacular season? And, you know, if Liverpool are to go on and lift the Premier League trophy, they'll be domestic champions. They won the European Cup last season. Does this come with a bit of a tinge of disappointment going forward?
Well, I think, you know, that certainly, you know, the Liverpool fan base is a very inquisitive one, which does hold the club and every decision that it makes to account. You know, it's got, you know, the spirit of Shankly Pressure Group, who have been thanked in a statement by Peter Moore for their involvement in the last couple of days, along with the Mayor of Liverpool, Joe Anderson, the Metro Mayor, Steve Rotherham. You know, all these people are interested, and they understand the importance of Liverpool as a football club in the context of the local business community, because so many, you know, so many businesses sort of need, you know, they coexist with Liverpool. You know, hotels, restaurants, bars, they all do well out of Liverpool. So, you know, that's why there is such an appetite to know what's going on at the club. And I think that, you know, no matter what happens, I think that there'll always be a level of distrust with the owners. It's just the reality of the way Liverpool fans think about the people that run their club. It's not necessarily, distrust might be a bit too strong, but people will always question what they do. So that will never change, no matter what. Even after Liverpool won the Champions League last year, Liverpool made the error around the trademarking issue, which they failed and didn't get in the end. You know, that was meant to be a summer of celebration. And I mean, I suppose that gives you some reference point to how people react. I mean, I don't think it really did spoil people's enjoyment of winning a, you know, the Champions League in Madrid. But nevertheless, it still leads you to think, well, what scheme have they got they're going to try next, I guess. You know, and I think that will always be an element of that within the Liverpool psyche. You know, it's a conspiratorial city anyway. You know, people always sort of trying to figure out what's going on at different levels of authority. So I think that's something that the owners have sort of maybe got used to some extent. But I say that, but, you know, they clearly haven't, they clearly have overlooked how the optics around this, and that's a term that I used in my article, that they haven't seen how this, despite maybe their intentions of thinking, well, we're actually protecting people's jobs here. You know, they haven't maybe stopped to consider how it looks to people who are viewing the situation, and equally, I guess, the workers.
Yeah. Well, my final thought is, what does this mean for the other clubs? Because you mentioned the pressure that's been growing. Tottenham, as I understand it, have no immediate plans to reverse their decision to furlough staff. Although in their statement, they did say they'll be reviewing it on an ongoing basis. And from people I've spoken to at the club, when they've asked the hierarchy if this situation's going to change, that phrase has been repeated. It's being reviewed on an ongoing basis. We've seen Norwich do it. We've seen Bournemouth do it. And there's a very good chance that many others will follow suit. Manchester City and Manchester United have said they won't be. But if vast swathes of the Premier League do, the longer this goes on, what sort of position will Liverpool be in? And will they regret the fact that they reversed their decision in the first place if everyone else jumps on board? We'll wait and see on that one. But Simon, thank you as always. It's a pleasure.
Well, we're lucky to draw on the knowledge of some of the sharpest minds in football journalism on this podcast, but our next guest is probably the biggest brain that we've had on. No offence, David.
Probably. Definitely.
All right, you're going definitely. Okay. A first-class degree in economics, currently doing a master's, is still only 26 as well. Welcome to the podcast, Sunderland player Duncan Watmore. Hi, Duncan.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. When I was growing up, right, which was before you were born by a very, very long way, but Steve Coppell was always held up as the only footballer to have a degree. And whenever Steve Coppell was mentioned in an interview, it was always referenced that he had a degree. The same thing seems to happen with you a little bit. Do you mind that?
No, not at all. I enjoy it. I mean, the past couple of years, obviously, I've been injured a lot. So I see myself more as an economist who plays a bit of football the past couple of years. I'm hoping to change that back to a footballer who does a bit of economics.
Where are you at the moment, fitness-wise and health-wise? Because you have had a horrific 3 years, 4 years, maybe?
It's obviously been a very bad 3 years. However, I feel since I first did my knee, which was... three and a bit years ago, I feel as fit as I have since then, which is great. So I've had 6 or 7 months without any real injuries. I've been available for every game. And yeah, I was just starting to get into the swing of things. And obviously now we can't play anymore. But I'm very happy with my personal level of fitness and how my body's coping. And I feel as robust as I have done for a long time. So that's great.
I was quite curious of how you've been sort of occupying yourself. Is it with your studies or is it with a bit of fitness?
Most mornings is taken up by exercise, you know, going on 5-10K runs or whatever the sports scientist has said for that day. And then, yeah, the majority of the day I've been obviously working on my dissertation, which is due in about 8 weeks' time for my master's.
And that's a master's in?
International leadership, business and management. And the dissertation I'm doing is on Common Goal, which is obviously the charity that I'm a member of and I donate to. And it's this idea that basically you give 1% of all footballers give 1% of their annual earnings to use basically football as a tool for positive social change. And it's something that I feel quite passionately about. And I also feel is probably not grown as much as I kind of expected or hoped. So this dissertation is kind of around working out where's the best route to grow Common Goal.
There are so many different areas that we could go with you during this interview. So when you say not grown as you thought it would or you hoped it would, do you mean within football?
I know so many footballers that are so giving and they are, you know, there's so many people that are willing to help and do give to charities and they do so privately and they don't need the accolades and they don't necessarily want the accolades of it. So I know that the willingness is there because, you know, people outside of football may not recognise that, but I've met so many people who are, you know, very, very good people in the football industry and who help out an awful amount. That's where I kind of just hope that Common Goal would get more and more members because I know the willingness is out there and it's just whether there is, you know, a lack of understanding of it or whether people just want to do their own thing. I don't know what it is, but it's that's kind of where I'm getting at. I know it can, it can be even bigger.
So this is it's a twofold question then. This, how did you become part of Common Goal? I mean, do you ring up One Matter or the people who run it and go, I'd like to join? Because some footballers might not know that. Some footballers who might be listening to us. And if footballers want to go under the radar with the good things that they're doing, can you be part of Common Goal privately?
I got in touch with the Common Goal organisers who run the charity and said that I was interested. And then they rang me back and they gave me a lot of detail about the charity and what it's about and what they're trying to do. And I was just really interested and really on board with the idea. So, you know, I signed up immediately. But the second question is, yeah, it's an interesting one, that, because as far as I know, the idea or the main kind of premise is that if we get more and more public members, especially high profile members in the Premier League and, you know, in international footballers around the world, the idea is you could use that kind of profile to build up Common Goals. So going privately, I suppose, wouldn't help that cause in a way. But obviously, a lot of players do want to help and do so privately. So I don't know if that is an option or not. It's something that they probably should look into.
Because I think it's a fine balancing act for footballers in that, and we're seeing this at the moment as well, in that you go, you make it public, and then the society, some members of society react with, oh, look at him just doing it for the publicity, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, as you say, you keep it private, and then the message doesn't get out there as much. That's a fine, it's a fine line.
Yeah, exactly, it is. And it's yeah, it's careful like how, where to tread on it, because as you say, you don't want to be doing these charitable causes just for the PR or the kind of just to get your name out and get some goodwill. You want to do it because you genuinely believe in the causes and you know you can help and you're in a position to help. But at the same time, as you say, some people just do not like the limelight and they want to make sure that they're helping but without showing any kind of public nature of it. And then all of a sudden you're not using your profile to push the charitable causes that you believe in. So it is a very tricky line.
That brings us nicely on to what's happening over the last few days around footballers possibly donating to the coronavirus crisis, to the NHS and various other proposals like wage cuts and deferrals. There seems to be a debate raging with players wanting to do a lot, but not necessarily knowing the best channel for it. Some players want to donate to this collective fund that Jordan Henderson's gained headlines for. They would also accept salary cuts, deferrals, if it was to help the staff within their clubs and make sure they're not laid off. And on top of that, they also have their own initiatives like Common Goal and many other things. We've seen Marcus Rashford and various others in the news. How difficult have you found the last few days as a player, and how do you feel that players are feeling at the moment when they're being attacked by politicians, or maybe not attacked, but they're being called out by politicians in a way that many other wealthy business people and earners are not?
Being difficult as a player is probably something that as players we should recognise. It's not that difficult at all for us because, you know, there are people who are literally risking their lives every day, the NHS workers and the essential workers around the country who are keeping us going and keeping this country running. So I think this is also a really important time to kind of step back and look at the wider perspective of football and its position in society. And so that's the first thing I'd say is how amazing, obviously, those people have been in this time. And as footballers, we do feel that we have a responsibility, obviously, to give back to society. And that's why, as you mentioned, there is a lot of willingness to help and to find a way to contribute to this fund that Jordan Henderson or whatever route they want to go down to help the NHS and the wider society. It's just a question of how do you unite these efforts and how do you get it so that everyone is on board. I mean, I saw Rooney's comment yesterday, which was like, maybe you could, it'd just be an individual basis. Some might be able to do 5%, some might be able to do 30%. And it is a tricky one. How do you unite these efforts? Do you have a blanket percentage? Is it just individuals, what they want to give? And I don't know how best to unite. And it's going to be obviously tricky in the next few weeks. But what I do hope, and I'm sure will happen, is that the football industry will do their bit and stand up and help a lot, because there are a lot of people in football that are really, really good people, and I hope that will come through in this time.
And it does strike me that the footballers, in the main, are trying to pick their way through a very difficult situation to make sure that they get it right. And there are so many complexities to it, from who owns the football club that you play for, and how wealthy they are and what they can do to help the staff, to if you donate, where it goes to maybe even, Duncan, how complicated a player's contract is, which I think a lot of us just think, oh, Premier League players, they'll just get 100 grand a week in their account and there you go. But I would imagine there are more complexities to that. And on top of all of that, as we saw with Stephen Naismith at Hearts, when he took a 50% pay cut, he didn't want to come out and talk about it or preach about it because he realised that there were different players at different levels economically within the Hearts squad. And I would imagine, for example, when you started out at Sunderland, having moved from Altrincham to be a Premier League player, your contract might have been very different to one of the senior players at Sunderland who had been a Premier League regular.
Yeah, exactly that. There are so many different complexities and every person's in a different boat. And, you know, some have families to support, some are in different financial burdens to others. And it is just a different... Every person's unique and everyone has their own unique financial situation. And as you said, contracts can be very complex. And it was interesting, yeah, what you said about the clubs and the owners, because, you know, there are lots of, even in the Premier League, you look at the clubs and could you put a blanket over the whole Premier League when you've got some clubs that are owned by, you know, very wealthy individuals, such, you know, Chelsea or City or whatever. And then you've got other clubs at the other side of the Premier League who you know, maybe don't have that financial backing. And so it's very tricky to know how to kind of put on a blanket answer to this situation, because every situation is unique and some clubs rely much more heavily on match day revenue while others just rely on broadcasting rights and that's their main income. And you can even see that as the leagues go down, the difference between the Premier League and say League One and League Two, you might have the typical contract situation in Premier League might be 4 or 5 years, whereas individuals in League One and League Two might only be a 1 or 2 year contract. So you come to June 30th and all of a sudden 50-60% of the squad are out of contract, as opposed to the Premier League, where maybe only 15% are out of contract. And match day revenue obviously gets more important the lower down you go in the leagues as well. So there's so many complexities to this football challenge about what to do with the season and what to do with obviously the donations and all that. So it's a very complex situation, but I just hope that we as an industry can do the right thing.
It really would appear that this is going to go down to a case-by-case basis, because you've got some players who do earn a hell of a lot of money and do have a hell of a lot of outgoings and existing commitments that don't actually allow them, as one of their advisors was telling me a couple of nights ago, don't actually allow them to commit the sorts of money that some people would like to see them commit. One Premier League player said to me that despite all of this, we're wasting too much time here. There are people dying en masse in hospitals in the UK and all over the world. We're waiting, we're discussing how these things can be set up, but we want to donate now. And that must be a really tricky position for footballers. There are various complexities, but also this is a matter of urgency.
Exactly. It's something that you don't want to waste time and be inefficient about when the money's needed now and the help's needed now. And as you say, it is a matter of life and death. That's how grave the situation's got. And so I completely echo those sentiments that I just hope that it's resolved quickly.
When you stop playing, which I guess you hope will be many years yet, what do you want to do?
I'm not entirely sure. I think I'd like to do something. I mean, obviously I could change in the next few years, but I think I'd like to do something related to my economics and business degree, but maybe with football as well. So maybe I wouldn't be on the actual playing side of coaching, etc. But who knows whether I could go down a different route that involves both football and kind of the business side that I'm working on with my degree and master's that really interests me.
There aren't many that go down that route, and that's why I asked it, really, because, you know, you talk to people within the game, they could do with more people who go down that route.
And hopefully that's the kind of route that opens up to me and I'm able to do it, because I think it would be something that would really interest me and it would be a nice change, I suppose, after a few years of football to do something maybe more on the business side.
And given your specialism around economics and what we've been talking about and what's being discussed in the game at the moment is largely focused on the finances and the money, is there any way, or are you involved with the PFA? Could they lean on your brains in a way that perhaps is not being lent upon among the playing fraternity at the moment?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's many, many more qualified people than me in the world to kind of make these decisions. And so I have trust in their kind of decision making. But obviously, if anyone was to approach me and ask my opinion, I'd give it and help if I could.
And you've got a lot on your plate at the moment. We haven't even mentioned the fact that you've had to possibly cancel your wedding, but even more importantly, your contract ends at the end of June as things stand, although it seems like FIFA would be bumping that along. So is that something that's a pressing concern to you at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my wedding's looks like it's going to be cancelled, which Sophie has been a bit upset about. So I've been dealing with that, but that will all work out. But in terms of the contract, I think it is an interesting situation because half of Sunderland players, or close to half, are out of contract on June the 30th. So I don't know how that's going to get resolved. But as you said, I think it might just be a case of FIFA bumping that along a couple of months to extend the season. And if that's the case, then I'm sure that'll work out well for everyone. And then it will all become clear. But there's so much uncertainty around, I mean, the whole world at the moment, that you can't really be making predictions or planning for anything. You've just kind of got to deal with it on a day-by-day basis, I suppose.
Away from the crisis, before the crisis started in this country, are they still filming you? Is there a third series
the
coming?
The key question.
No, there's not. After the second season, they stopped filming. So they hinted that they might want to come back for a third season, but this season there's been no cameras on us.
Right. How did you? I mean, I haven't watched the whole of the second series yet. I'm only about 2.5 episodes in, something like that. So you're not in it. You're not in it yet. Was it difficult? Did you get used to it? How did you find it?
Yeah, I mean, my personal kind of perspective was, I where possible, didn't really want to be in it or advertise myself in it. If they asked for an interview and they wanted me to, of course, I'd do that. And I did do a lot of them throughout, but I suppose everyone does. They film so much footage for such a small amount of time that you kind of, like, for example, the first season, the amount of footage that I must have filmed with them during my rehab and injury, and then I'm just end up not being in it. So it's because they just film so many hours and hours and hours of footage across the whole season, and they can only cut it down to, what, 8 1-hour episodes or whatever it is. So you do get used to it, and you kind of accept that what you're saying and what you're being filmed is probably not going to end up on the show anyway. And yeah, it would have just been nice if we could have ended either of the seasons with a better outcome.
Can you see the benefits of it? Because do you watch the others? I mean, have you watched? I'm obsessed with the test at the moment, the Australian cricket.
Oh, I've just started that as well. Oh, it's brilliant.
Duncan, it's amazing. I spoke to Justin Langer over the weekend, did an interview with him for the radio.
Oh, awesome.
And I said to him, this is just utterly ridiculous. I'm really loving the Australian cricket team. I really like you. I really like the Australian cricket team. How has that happened to me?
Exactly. I feel the same way. It's crazy.
Yeah.
No, I just started watching the test maybe a couple of days ago, and what a likeable team.
Yeah.
You sound like you're slightly uncomfortable with Sunderland Till I Die in terms of the fact that it's been portrayed in a very light-hearted, I mean, a very popular, but also a very light-hearted and almost at times mocking way. And it was that something you were sort of keen not to be heavily involved with?
Yeah, I just think obviously the makers of this documentary were big Sunderland fans, and they had Sunderland's interests at heart. And I just felt, I mean, everyone was different. Some people wanted to get on the camera and you know, portray what they were doing, and I wasn't so keen to do that necessarily. And as you say, it's not necessarily a light-hearted issue, because it means so much to all the people of Sunderland, and we've had a couple of bad, really, really bad seasons. And yeah, it's just not nice to relive those kind of memories when you know how much it means to, well, myself and the players and all the fans in the area, which is, you know, such a big club, and the club means so much to them. And we've come down two divisions in a league we shouldn't necessarily be in, and we need to, you know, put that right on the pitch, and that's sometimes got to be the priority.
It's been great talking to you. Just finally, because people might not know, when this all started for you going to Sunderland, you actually left non-league Altrincham to go to Sunderland, who are a club very close to my heart and not very far from my house at all. Do you go back and watch them at all?
I've been back a couple of times. I mean, every time they have a game is when we have games.
So yes,
it's tricky. But we've just like there's been a fundraising.
Yeah, there has. Yeah.
Yeah, to get Ultring again. So I help with that. But I like staying in touch with Ultringham because they're such a family run club. They're such a good club, and they did so much for me in my early days. So I still speak to the chairman quite regularly. And a few of the players that I played with back then are still there. They're still
Densmore,
the main core of the team.
Yeah, Densmore, Malt.
Yeah, Densmore, Malt, Richmond. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, these players I all played with, all really good lads. So it's a brilliant club, and it's something that I'll always stay in touch with.
The other thing, and this is what I like about them, every time you do anything, they mention it. They're so proud of what you have gone on to do. But that to me, that's actually what non-league, lower league football is. It's not resenting players when they move on. It's actually celebrating them, particularly when they get the opportunity that you got. And that to me sums up non-league and lower league football.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, Ultringham is just such a brilliant family club. They look after you so well, and they really, really care about you. And that happens all across non-league football, and it's so nice for me to have experienced that side of football before obviously being bought by Sunderland, and it's something that I'll always treasure and be very grateful for.
Yeah, I've just got a final question as well. Your parents have very interesting roles, so your dad is going to be taking up the chief executive position of the ECB, and that will allow you to get a bit closer to your newfound Australian cricketing stars at some point.
No, let's not go too fast. Still don't like them that much.
And your mother is a vicar, and I was quite intrigued to know what sort of role faith is playing among sporting people at a time like this, or how she's finding life with her sort of community in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a really, really important time for my mum, because she's such a typically the parishioners are an elderly community, and they are in her area too, and so they are isolated, and a lot of them are lonely, and they can't come to services on a Sunday, which is, you know, their solace for a lot of them. So my mum's doing everything she can. She's doing online sermons, she's doing online hymns and prayers, she's making that accessible to loads of people, and she's ringing up her parishioners, especially her elderly lonely and isolated ones, and she's just trying to keep that sense of community and faith strong amongst the parishioners, and she's doing an amazing job at it. But it is a very, very tricky time, and it's a very important time, because in times like these you do rely on your faith very heavily, and so she's trying her best to provide that service as best she can in these tricky times.
It's been brilliant having you on.
We've
taken up quite a lot of your time, and you have a dissertation to write, so we were better let you go. But thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I really, really enjoyed it, and it was great speaking to you guys. So thanks so much.
Do you like beer? Do you like free? Well, how about, and you may have guessed this, free beer. As a valued listener, we'd like to bestow upon you just that. Thanks to our good pals at beer52.com, you have the opportunity to sip 8 delicious, painstakingly sourced craft beers from around the world. All you need to do is go to www.beer52.com/footy and cover just the postage of £4.95. You've got to pay the postie. And as if that wasn't enough, as a listener of the Ornstein and Chapman podcast, you'll get 2 extra free beers. So that's basically 10 free beers. Beer 52 are beer pioneers. They traverse the globe to find the best and most interesting beer from the greatest small batch breweries planet Earth has to offer. So no surprise then that they are the world's most popular craft beer discovery club. Each month, Beer 52 delivers a case with a different theme. Themes have included Germany, Korea, Belgium, South Africa, California, New Zealand, and many more. But they haven't forgotten their roots. As an independent UK company, Beer 52 are passionate about the UK craft beer scene. And the beauty of Beer 52 is that you can leave any time. The power is in your hands. As well as the best, most interesting beer money can buy, your case will include the award-winning craft beer magazine Ferment, which explains the theme and individual beers you'll receive. And a beery snack is thrown in just to top it all off. If you don't like dark beers, choose the light plan. It's easy. All you've got to do, go to www.beer52.com/footy to get your case free. And don't forget, right now, Ornstein and Chapman podcast listeners get 2 extra free beers. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much to Duncan once again, David, for joining us. He was sensational, wasn't he?
Brilliant. Absolutely priceless. I enjoyed that.
Make sure you subscribe to The Athletic to read in full great articles from some of the best, most informed football writers around. All of our podcasts are free. Ad-free versions are available to subscribers. And actually, you can subscribe free for 90 days now. Just head to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. Theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman, and you'll get access to everything completely free for 90 days. That's it. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.